Tonight's topic is tending our inner gardens. You know, we're very funny beings, we humans. I was recently musing about how dear we are. We're always dealing with people and business, and meanwhile, we're walking around with this whole inner garden that only we know, and even we can never fully know it. There's so much inside us. This, you know, metaphor of the garden, there are flowering plants, vegetables, ugly weeds and thistles, and sometimes the weeds are choking out the wholesome plants. Some places are so dense that we can't tell what plants are in there. Most people can't imagine what goes on inside the gardens of their minds, but meditators can. Beginners are often horrified by their first glimpse of the wild mind. But after a few years of practice, we have a sense of the sorts of things that are in our minds. When we do some sustained practice, like sitting every day, or daily life practice, or going on retreat, we develop a kind of map of what's in here, what makes each plant grow, and how to reduce the number of weeds. So tonight we'll take a look at what the major categories of weeds are and how we can best tend these inner gardens of ours. It's so much fun to watch newborn babies. I know I've mentioned this before, but it's one of my favorite things to do. The way they look around, they're fascinated, but uncomprehending. You can tell they have no idea what's going on, but they're fascinated. And they have their reactions. They don't understand it. They know what they like, and they know what they don't like. After all, they were born crying. They're also often very easily delighted, and they can cry for no discernible reason. Even when their world is as perfect as it can get. This shows that that supposedly empty field of their minds is beginning to grow into a garden that may bewilder, please, or terrify them. I cannot imagine what they're reacting to when they wake up from a dream screaming. I mean, what do they have to dream about? But they really have a very powerful emotional life. They can't possibly know about old age, sickness, and death, but they still cry more than we do. This is dukkha-dukkha. It's one of the three kinds of suffering or inner dissatisfaction. Dukkha-dukkha is the suffering of being in a body on this planet. We're in these bodies that are so vulnerable in so many ways to so much in this world. And these bodies are difficult to live in. They have their pleasures for sure, but there's so much discomfort. An empty tummy or a full diaper. Not being held for so long. And babies haven't ever had even to brush their teeth. But we do. You know, maintenance of these bodies is a full-time job. In fact, that's why we have jobs, to feed, shelter, clothe, medically attend to, and try to please these bodies. You know, it's no wonder that we retire from our jobs. As we get older, there's more and more maintenance that we have to do for these bodies. We have medicines to take, exercises, and physical therapy to do. And still, the regular showers to take, food to eat, clothes to buy and wear, and a home to maintain. It never ends. Dukkha is the baseline of our lives, even if we live in the Garden of Eden. There are always things, experiences that are pleasant or unpleasant. There are always things that we don't have, things we lose, like people. This stuff happens. So this is the dukkha of that first arrow that I'm sure you've heard referred to before. That's the one that just hits us. Some pain in life is simply inescapable. And all we can do when we're hit with it is to endure it and then fix it as well as we can. We can also, if we want, mentally suffer over it, focus on the pain and then the trouble afterward, and magnify it, fussing about it. That's a second arrow that we shoot ourselves with. The suttas tell us that even those who have achieved nibbana will still experience dukkha. But they don't get distressed and shoot themselves with a second arrow over it. Now, dukkha may seem like more than enough suffering for a lifetime, but there are two other forms of dukkha. Viparinama dukkha has to do with the impermanent nature of what we think is reality. Our sense of time tells us this stuff around us, what babies are gazing at so intently, is here and real. And we tend to think it will be here an hour from now or tomorrow, but not necessarily. Have you ever tried to pitch a tent in a strong wind? I did just a few weeks ago. I put down the tarp and then started to open the tent, and the tarp had moved and just kept moving. I was chasing it around with the tent. That's how life can feel sometimes. Change is the thief that steals all the ripe fruit from our gardens. We have what we've wanted. We enjoy it a while. And then it's gone. I woke this morning to find one of my carefully potted and irrigated tomato plants lying on its side, probably thanks to a raccoon or 20-mile-an-hour winds last night. But I saw no point in fussing about it. As soon as I could, I went out, put it upright, and repaired the damage to the plant. So this is the dukkha of liking and not liking some things and not others. Or not really feeling either way. All three of these feelings, liking, not liking, neutral, altogether are called Vedana. We will never get everything just how we want it and have it stay that way. Even our likes and dislikes change. Viparinama dukkha is the collision of impermanence and Vedana, which dictate our preferences. We simply can't always be completely happy with the way things are. Period. Not going to happen. Then there's Sankara dukkha, which helps explain why. Bhikkhu Bodhi, one of my favorite writers, did a brilliant analysis of Sankara, which contains the essential Buddhist worldview. Millennia ago, the Buddha understood what science has just recently revealed, that everything that exists in any moment has come into being from other things combining into it. All those things are so dynamic. I often say that things are really verbs, not nouns. They are always in this process of change, even though it is often slower than we can see. These principles also apply to the mind and what we think of as its contents. Our gardens. They're always changing. Memories, too. They are not stored in the brain like videos on your hard drive. They are experienced as elements. Where you were in relation to what you experienced, the story of what happened, and how you felt about it, etc., etc. Each of those elements is stored with other similar nature elements in separate areas of the brain. And in with these elements are, as I said, the elements of other experiences, including the various times that you remembered that event. So it's not surprising that memories change. Each time we remember a particular event, the brain reassembles the elements from these different areas of the brain a little bit differently. So it is inevitable that babies grow up with inner gardens that are often composed of distorted understandings, attitudes, and attachments. Everything in our experience has come from other things coming together and becoming other things. And this process of becoming is continuous, including our sense of self. In Pali, these combinations are called sankharas, often translated as formations, and usually discussed in the suttas as mental formations. Our experience is a swiftly growing garden where everything is constantly coming into being and passing away. Every week, another plant is in bloom, and last week's flowers have faded. These sankharas, or formations, generate our thoughts, emotions, attitudes, assumptions, emotional habits like moods, dispositions, fear, anxiety, depression, etc., which in turn influence the way we experience the next moment. How we see things, in turn, determines the way we relate to it all and what we do about it. It's complicated. It may sound lush and inviting, but the truth is that we're now in territory way past that second arrow. Now we're in a free fall of arrows, spears, artillery, and cavalry charges. In fact, our mental formations, sankharas, can hold suffering in themselves, depending on how ethically and mindfully we have or haven't been living. Most sankharas, whether they're attitudes or values or whatever decisions that we made that we're still holding on to, or our emotional dispositions, they're all composed in part by the way we liked or disliked past events and the dukkha that our reactions caused. All of that suffering is held like a seed in the sankharas. For example, that you are craving for me to explain what I'm talking about. For example, we watch a person do certain things repeatedly, and we conclude that they are a certain type of person. And we have already decided that we don't like or approve of that sort of person. So wrapped up tight in that assumption is ill will. And ill will just feels nasty. We may get used to it, but it gives our lives a base note of dissatisfaction. We carry this around and multiply that by all the attitudes and other sankharas our minds concoct, and you have a troubled mind. Add to that the nature of some things to be inherently painful to us, or provide a pleasure which cannot last, and the fact that the tarp will not stay put while we struggle to place the tent on top of it, and we are almost bursting with dukkha. Now, those familiar with the Satipatthana Sutta may have noticed a similarity between it and the three types of dukkha that I've just talked about. Both teachings start with the body, deal with our reactions to impermanence or our vedana, liking, not liking, and being neutral, and progress to the complex swirl of things combining in the mind, containing the seeds of more dukkha. Body, vedana, mind. The Satipatthana Sutta lays out four foundations of mindfulness. The first three are body, vedana, and mind. And these three foundations generally correspond to dukkha dukkha, viparinama dukkha, and sankhara dukkha. This correspondence is a good thing. It gives us the tool We need to tend our gardens. That tool is mindfulness. The Satipatthana Sutta also tells us how to use that tool. There's a refrain in the sutta that many people see repeatedly and sort of gloss over as they read it. It says that we should practice being mindful of the body, vedana, and the mind while we are ardent, alert, and without greed or distress or clinging to anything in the world. This technique does what the suttas call stilling the formations, or sankharas. We take the dukkha out of the sankharas as we observe our responses to being in this body, like having to go to the dentist. And we simultaneously suspend or let go of our greed or distress or clinging. I tried this about a week ago. It was very helpful. We do the same thing when we closely watch our vedana. Say, in the moment we first notice that we like or don't like some new experience. Also, while letting go of any greed or distress or clinging. On my last forest retreat, just a few days ago, I went for a walk and noticed the feeling of liking a neighboring campsite, intentionally letting go of any craving to move my tent to that campsite. So we do the same practice in being mindful of the mind itself, observing how our moods and attitudes generate dukkha. Also, without greed or distress or clinging to anything in the world. You can see why this refrain is repeated dozens of times in the sutta, because there are so many different things that it suggests that we be mindful of, but always with this attitude of letting go. We go into our gardens with the spade of mindfulness and apply this powerful technique of letting go in the moment when dukkha arises. We practice unbinding from dukkha as we experience it, over and over. Every gardener knows you have to keep going into the garden and tending it. These are the weeds we need to remove. Mindfulness is the tool, and we use it by letting go as each form of dukkha begins to arise. And we can do that as we're meditating, as we're walking down the street, whatever we're doing. As we notice dukkha arise, let it go. Eventually, the sankharas get neutralized, become stilled, and stop generating our suffering. The garden of the mind becomes a pleasant place to live while we keep being mindful and taking care of it. Thank you.